Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Mars, we are back. The Mars lander is there. The reentry was successful. It was very exciting. Alan Boyle is with GeekWire. I saw the celebration at JPL, and the landing was apparently courtesy of Aerojet Rocketdyne in Redmond, huh?
Well, yeah, Aerojet had a big part in the landing as well as the navigation of the Mars InSight lander during its nearly seven-month cruise to Mars. Aerojet provides some thrusters that help keep the spacecraft on track during the cruise, and then they have a set of 12 thrusters that were the final climax of the descent and landing. And so those thrusters are what really got it to the surface in good order.
And it's called the InSight Lander. It's a complicated acronym, but basically this is not just going to take pictures of the Martian surface, which of course we've seen before, but it's going to drill down into it. How deep is it going to drill?
There's an instrument on there that's called the MOLE or HP cubed that will go down as far as 15 feet. And it'll take measurements along the way so that it figures out how much heat is coming from the interior of Mars. And that could help figure out not only how the planet was formed, but what the heat level might be down beneath, where people think that if there's any life that still exists on Mars, they think that it's got to be underground.
Well, plus, if it was fortunate enough to land on an old landfill, it might drill into a refrigerator or something. That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, all right. Now you're thinking.
Ultimately, of course, this is supposed to teach us something about how the Earth was formed, because Mars and the Earth are made of roughly the same materials. So what kind of science, useful science, do you anticipate coming out of this?
Well, there's really quite a lot that hasn't been looked at very closely before. So it will really chart the complete interior composition on the planet that is going to help scientists figure out what the core is made of. And the core is a very crucial part of Mars's history, because it's thought that Mars lost its water and its atmosphere because its core was too small. And so there's going to be a lot of information, not pretty pictures so much, because it's kind of a boring area where this place landed. And someone said, you know, there's no place that's boring on Mars, but this is a flat terrain. You're not going to see the sorts of mountains that you see in pictures from the Curiosity rover. And so it's all about what's inside Mars.
Now, does this in any way hasten a manned mission to Mars?
There are some missions that are going to do that, like the 2020 rover that's supposed to be launched in 2 years. This one, it's a little more indirect, that there's more of a holistic understanding of how Mars was formed and what the geology is like. And I can imagine that there are some things that people would want to know. You know, how strong do the earthquakes get on Mars? And what do you have to watch for? Is it warm enough that you could tap into liquid water? So they're not really direct experiments. For example, on the 2020 rover, there's an experiment to make oxygen from the Martian atmosphere, which is really interesting, but more kind of the broad picture of the science of Mars.
Well, are they thinking, for example, that the drill could possibly hit an aquifer of some kind, or would it all be ice?
I think it would all be ice. I think hoping to hit an aquifer when you go down that far is maybe a bridge too far. But if you get the information about how the heat flow works on Mars, you could probably infer, well, here's how deep you'd have to go to get to an aquifer. And that's very valuable information for future manned missions.
Would the manned mission, would the route taken by the manned mission be roughly the same, this 7 month journey?
Pretty much. And I should correct myself that we're not going to try calling these manned missions. We're going to call them crewed missions from now on. But 7 to 9 months is roughly how long it's going to take. And so you really have to know what the radiation environment is going to be, not only between Mars and Earth, but when you get to the Martian surface. And so future missions and some past missions are really trying to characterize what humans are going to face when they get to Mars.
Because this landing was not something crazy like the bouncy ball landing. This seemed to be a more standard, the standard type of landing you would have to perform if you had a manned mission, with the parachute gradually slowing it down, and then finally the retro rockets at the end there.
Well, yes and no. That this type of landing procedure where you use the thrusters is good for probes of this size. But when you get into payloads of a ton or more, you really do have to kind of come up with some pretty out there landing techniques. For example, the 2012 rover Curiosity and the 2020 rover are going to use a sky crane where there's a rocket powered platform that lowers the one ton lander and rover to the surface. And you've got to come up with something even more daring to land the sorts of large payloads that you would need for human missions. And so this is something that SpaceX is already thinking about with the rocket that they now call the Starship, a spaceship that would land with a super powerful rocket. And NASA is also looking at architectures that could get those sorts of payloads down, but it's not going to be as easy, if you can ever call a Mars landing easy, it's not going to be as easy as the one that we saw this week.
Really? A sky crane?
Yeah, and it worked once. It might work again. So that's what NASA is counting on. If it doesn't work, we're in a whole lot of trouble, Dave.
Well, very exciting, and it went without a hitch. So good for Aerojet Rocketdyne, and good for NASA. That's it's very exciting. Alan Boyle from GeekWire. Alan, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You have to call it a crewed mission, not a manned mission, to be sex neutral. Although that makes it sound like you're sending a bunch of people who have no manners to Mars. You say a crewed mission.
Well, that, or we might be sending robots.
Or robots. Washington voters decided just a few weeks ago to change the laws on prosecuting police when they use force improperly. And now, it was called Initiative 940, in case you forgot. And now supporters and opponents of 940 are moving ahead with plans to change that law. Now, how can that happen so soon? Because initiatives are supposed to stay intact for 2 years before they tweak them. That's why Kyria's Hannah Scott is here to explain all that.
I will. So it was a long and windy road to get police accountability measure I-940 onto the November ballot anyway. That initiative makes it easier to prosecute police in use of deadly force cases by removing the need to prove malice and defining a good faith standard. It also requires police to render first aid to those they use force on and also go through new mental health and de-escalation training. Now, the language in the initiative to the legislature was opposed by law enforcement, and that led to a major agreement between all sides to a different version that was eventually passed and then shot down by the courts because of the process that it was used to get there. That just left 940 on the ballot for the voters. And before Election Day, all sides had promised that they would go ahead and move forward with that other version that was shot down by the courts eventually, no matter what happened with I-940. So the big question after nearly 60% of the voters approved 940 was whether they were going to stick to that now that original version had passed. And Democratic Representative Roger Goodman says they are.
We met recently, just last week, and all of the parties have agreed that we will enact this consensus agreement to improve and clarify the initiative to everyone's liking.
So the group behind 9940 De-Escalate Washington tells me they are also committed to this as well, and as are the police groups, including the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, as well as others who support this clarifying bill. Tweaking the past initiative still does away with that need for prosecutors to prove malice, which is a big deal. That's been a big bar to trying to prosecute any use of deadly force cases in our state. But it also better defines that good faith standard.
Basically, the bottom line is, if a reasonable law enforcement officer would have used deadly force in those circumstances, it's justified. If a reasonable officer would not have used deadly force, then it's not justified. And then a prosecutor can decide whether or not to bring charges. 940 set up a kind of a complicated two-part test. Did the officer in question believe it was reasonable? And would a reasonable officer, sort of an objective standard, have believed it was reasonable?
So these are subtle changes here.
It's really not a huge deal, but everybody makes it a huge deal. And there were really big concerns on the part of law enforcement with the language. And even the De-Escalate Washington folks believed, once they were pointed out to them, that, yeah, it could be better, because that was very confusing. So this amended version would get rid of that and simplify it, like you said. Another big deal in this amended version would deal with investigations.
Let's say there's a questionable shooting and there's an investigation. Should the police department involved be part of that investigation? And the answer is clearly no. What we found is that the collective bargaining agreements, the contracts between law enforcement and the different communities around Washington State, almost all of them say that the police department should not be involved in the investigation if there's a questionable shooting. So we just put that in the law, that investigations need to be completely independent of the department that was involved in the shooting.
So that wasn't in the original I-940 that just passed. The other change is going to deal with the requirement for cops to render first aid to those they use force on.
Law enforcement have what's called the public duty. It's the public duty doctrine. Law enforcement are sworn to protect the public. And so what if there's still an active scene that they have to attend to? What if there are a number of people shot, including perhaps another law enforcement officer? And so we put language in this consensus agreement that makes clear that there's a proper balance between the public duty of law enforcement and the duty to render first aid.
So that amended version will now make it clear that cops can call for first aid and that securing that scene takes priority over anything else.
So there was some question that under the law as it is written, currently a cop would have to drop what he was doing if somebody was injured, even if it was a dangerous...
No, that's in I-940. The requirement to render first aid would have required that they give first aid, but it didn't allow for them to take precedence of securing the scene and things like that. That was another big concern for law enforcement. So all of those, that clearly explains everything that's going to be changed. All of the de-escalation training and mental health training that were in the original 940 are also in this amended version. But it's been, you know, a process to get it here. Everyone in law enforcement who does support this amended version wants this to get done. There are still some that maybe don't approve of either version. And Goodman says he doesn't think that'll be an issue. All of the stakeholders met behind closed door a week or so ago and pledged their support for this. Now, next week, we'll see exactly how much everyone supports this. They'll have a public meeting down at Olympia at 1:30 on Monday, where everyone is going to have their say. And you asked at the beginning of our conversation how this can be amended when it just got passed. It can be amended if they get a two-thirds majority. Otherwise, it takes 2 years before they can amend it. Goodman tells me he believes they have that two-thirds majority.
Okay, so this explains why they're going the extra mile to compromise between these two opposing groups, because they have to get a supermajority to get this done this year.
Yeah, absolutely. They have to get it. And it's not really a partisan issue. There hasn't been a lot of lawmakers who are against it. Most lawmakers said last session that they agreed with the clarifying bill, but they didn't agree with the process, which was found unconstitutional to get it done the way they had done it. So
that's refreshing. Republicans and Democrats, community groups and law enforcement working together to achieve an end that all of them will be comfortable with.
And it's a good, huge deal, both on the bipartisan level and also because you've got these groups. We're talking De-Escalate Washington, which involves members of family members of people who've been killed by the police who have sat down to make this. It's really a historic agreement. That's one thing that everyone I talk to on all sides of this tries to drive home. We've seen such divides between communities and police for so many years. This is an example of how things should be done, they say. So we'll see
how
it goes.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Spring Free Trampoline. In July of 2017, I shared the story of Cindy Meyer, a sister of one of our sales account executives here at Cairo Radio. Cindy at the time was in kidney failure, hoping to avoid dialysis through a kidney transplant.
It's gonna take a lot, but it's going to happen, and I just have to keep that attitude all the time.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. And this past July, a year after our initial story, Cindy did have to go on at-home dialysis. And we spoke by phone about her current health.
My filtration for my kidneys went down to 9%. And so at that time, we decided to go ahead and do the surgery to put the catheter into my stomach. And I've been doing dialysis ever since.
She spends about 8 hours every night hooked up to this dialysis machine. She has to in order to stay alive. And as a reminder, it's really hard to find a kidney donor for Cindy. She's not only O blood type, but she also has a rare blood sensitivity that would cause her body to reject most donations. Only about 1% of the population would be a match for her. Undeterred, her family recently decided to invoke the power of Coug Nation. She was at her sister's house a few weeks back, hooking up to dialysis, and took a portable TV with her so she wouldn't miss the Cougars game. And they wanted to show in the pictures how dedicated she is, not only to her health, but also to the Cougs. So they posted those pictures to the Die Hard Cougs Facebook fan group.
It went crazy. Viral. We had over 650 likes to the page. We had 116 comments. And I've had over 20 amazing Cougs, supporting Cougs, reaching out and wanting to test for me.
Leave it to the rabid fan base of Washington State University. Now Cindy has even more potential donors on her list to test. And I spoke to some of them. Autumn Lamb is all the way in Ohio. She's not even a Coug, but her friend is.
The friend of mine that posted it, we were friends since elementary school, and I just completely trust her and know that she wouldn't share something if it wasn't legit.
Plus, she's O blood type. I asked her how one decides to possibly give up a kidney to a stranger.
Because she does have such a high percentage rate of potential rejection from her body. To me, that seems like a faith thing that if I am supposed to be that donor for her, then all of those details would work out.
Then there's Julianne Chandler in Portland. This was the second time, actually, she's come across Cindy's story on Facebook.
Well, the first time I saw it, I had just had a baby, and I knew I was O blood type, but that, you know, I just had a baby, so everything was scrambled. But then I saw it this time, and I was like, oh yeah, I totally forgot about that. And so I figured my husband and I are both O blood type, so I sent a message and just kind of figured I'd see where it went.
If you missed that, Julianne and her husband are going to test for Sydney. For her, giving a kidney is as easy as the give a penny, take a penny expression.
Yeah, it doesn't worry me at all. I just hope that there's a match somewhere. And if it happens to be me, I would gladly give something, you know. If it was my child, I would hope somebody would step up and help. So I don't have any fear about it. Just kind of do what you got to do.
That is apparently the power of being a Washington State Cougar. Cindy says despite the hard year and a half since we last spoke, she's not losing hope.
It's a numbers game for me, so the more people that test, I know the closer I am to finding that donor. But it just goes to show you that we Cougs stick together. I never thought I would get any kind of a response like this, but it's been absolutely incredible.
Cindy says her insurance covers the cost of testing for you. If you're interested in trying, email the show through the inbox at mynorthwest.com. I can get you Cindy's phone number. She says, just call me. And as a reminder from my story in 2017, I know three people who have done this, and you can live a normal, healthy life after donating. So if you feel compelled, let the show know. I'll give you her contact information.
Still, that is a remarkable donation to make.
Mm-hmm.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from that epic traffic jam of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle. The status of Mike Leach, the Cougar coach, has he been sniffing around at a better job?
College coaching is the strangest carousel ever because you can still be under contract with your school and you can purportedly not be talking to anybody. And all of a sudden they're coming around you and floating ideas by your agent. So, no, he has not been actively seeking out a job as far as I know. That doesn't mean people aren't trying to create a scenario in which he would leave Washington State.
Is there, I mean, you kind of answer that question because surely, I mean, most people in their everyday jobs, they're thinking, okay, what's my next move? He has to be thinking about that.
Correct. And last year he was set, by all appearances, to go to Tennessee.
Oh.
So the idea that he could leave is certainly not out of the question.
Why would he after this, by all intents and purposes, a successful season?
The reason he'd leave is to test his offensive system at a bigger school at a more perennial power.
Oh.
Washington State, and this isn't to demean or the Washington State, there's probably a ceiling on the kind of talent you can get and recruit to Washington State. When he was going to Tennessee last year, there'd be a different environment. You would be able to recruit a different caliber of athlete.
So there's too much emphasis on education at Washington State.
Yes, and too little appeal of a very, very rural college town setting. And you would be able to. He's been very successful at Texas Tech and at Washington State. And those are two cities, schools in rural, remote spots who are kind of middle of the table conference teams in the respective conferences. And he's brought them and made them relevant and made them contend for titles and had incredible success.
Yes.
But doing it at a place like Tennessee, which has contended for national championships, would be different. The other part of this, though, is that Mike Leach is not the most attractive head coaching candidate at those bigger schools where things like fundraising and schmoozing with alumni and not saying controversial things tend to be very important.
What was that tweet about again?
He's different. It was promoting it took an Obama speech and took it entirely out of context.
It was a doctored video.
Correct. It wasn't an actual recording of his speech to make it sound like he was saying it was kooky, and he presented it under the I was just asking questions and what people thought about this. It ended up costing the school a significant donation, and his endorsement of Trump has been, quote unquote, controversial. I have no problem with it. I think we should hear more about what people honestly think rather than sort of the sanitized, I don't want to offend anybody version. But if I was an administrator at Washington State, I could also understand why, maybe not chime in on that stuff because it tends to cost us money in donations. The best rumor that's come out, and this is an idea about why Mike Leach might be difficult to employ, is that Texas Tech, where he used to work and where I believe he's suing, over his dismissal there, which stemmed from his alleged taking the son of a very prominent college football commentator, Craig James, who went to SMU, and treating his concussion by putting him in an equipment shed.
What?
I'm not exaggerating any of the controversy, which was that Craig James' son suffered a concussion, and whether it was a shed or a closet was debated about, but Leach suggested putting him there because bright lights hurt someone with a concussion.
Okay.
So he wanted him in a cool spot. He ended up getting fired after, and that was the last straw in a series of things. He ended up getting fired by Texas Tech, and he's suing him. And this was Mike Leach, quote, via text to one of the radios or one of the television stations in Texas Tech, which he said that before I would even talk to them, they would have to pay me the money that they owe me for 2009. And that might give you an idea about why some schools might be reticent. Because when
what about the NFL? When does a college coach know if he's for the NFL?
Oh, that's a great question.
He or she,
I'd love to see Mike Leach in the NFL and see how it works. NFL is reluctant to change. Oh. And he would be a very, very different offensive scheme than anything they've ever seen. They have not that would be the most revolutionary coaching hire in decades, to take someone like Mike Leach, and who doesn't believe in running the ball pretty much at all and just wants to manage the game according to his offensive principles, and try that against the speed of NFL defenses. I'd love to see it. Cleveland, come give him a shot. Let's go.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet.
At the United Nations Security Council,
Russia decided to prevent passage of the Ukrainian ships, rammed them, and then opened fire on them. This is no way for a law-abiding, civilized nation to act.
U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley condemning the sudden outbreak of shooting between Russian and Ukrainian ships. Let's bring in military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, so people can visualize where this is happening, first of all, you have the Black Sea just north of Turkey, and the Crimean Peninsula, which is attached to Ukraine, juts out into that. And then there's a strait between that and the Sea of Azov above it, which is where this is taking place, correct?
Correct. And so this is all about preventing Ukraine from transporting its goods through that strait into the Black Sea and off to the Mediterranean, while at the same time Russia looks to project power using naval assets to block this off and potentially keep them from doing it. Let's not forget that these two countries are at war. There's been over 10,000 Ukraine KIA in the past few years since this started. Russia has this continuous cyber war that's taking place against them. This is another low-level conflict that Vladimir Putin pulls to see how far he can go before the rest of the world either picks up a notice and does something about it.
And this is where Russia built that new bridge to connect the mainland to the peninsula.
That's right. And, you know, if you look at it from a geographical perspective, which military people do, he has to have this key terrain in order to have that bridge, in order to facilitate any kind of movement of material from Russia into Crimea, because it doesn't have any other way to connect without going directly through Ukraine.
So what do you think his goal here? What's left to be done? He's got the little green men infiltrating that area of Ukraine. Is he essentially trying to overthrow the current government of Ukraine and put a puppet in, or what?
He could be, or at least control the politicians in the southern part of Ukraine. And but this is a more hostile act because it now affects their economy and commerce. This could be a move that he's made internally to try to help his own standing with the Russian people, as he goes up and down when he doesn't show a powerful enough force without the world. He does this right before the G20 meeting and some other meetings that they're having place there, in order to, you know, kind of level set the playing field. And the United States and the rest of the world plays catch up and reacts and has to, you know, condemn this and do things that really, you know, kind of don't count in the heat of the moment when now the Ukraine ships have been held by the Russians and the situation has happened.
Now, is this something that NATO gets involved in? I hear that they've called an emergency meeting.
Well, it's not a NATO country, and while we have the Budapest Treaty that allows us to support the Ukraine from a defensive perspective, that was signed in 1993. You know, this gets back to, is it worth a fight for us? We have no other, you know, soldiers there. We couldn't get into a ground war. If Russia decided to get into a ground war, you know, it's unthinkable, but, you know, again, this is how world wars start. But if that would happen, it'd be over very quickly. The Russian military would overmatch them. It would be a tremendous amount of destruction. So that couldn't happen. We couldn't get there on time to influence that.
Yeah. So if they want to take over Ukraine, then they're going to do it.
And the thing is, Ukraine is a sore point for Vladimir Putin because they once tried to join NATO back 2010. I don't think it's a good idea to put them in NATO. We can't have every member nation in NATO is the only thing they require to be in NATO is you're not Russia. That would just make a situation that the Russians could finally decide to say, you know what, we're gonna roll tanks and we're gonna see if you guys are really willing to fight for these countries or not.
Right. Now, if that happens and they basically annex Ukraine, NATO does nothing, does that mean they then try their hand at annexing the Baltics?
Again, great question. And well, some of those countries now are NATO countries. You know, trying to look for an analogy, you've got perhaps, you know, 1938 with the annexation of Austria and Czechoslovakia into Germany. The question gets back to how much the world thinks that Vladimir Putin has imperialistic visions. We've heard him say to get the Soviet Union back together again. He thinks that was the greatest downfall in the history of his country. Just as a matter of whether or not we think he's serious or not doing that.
CBS military analyst, retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Mike, thank you. And on Tuesdays, we head to the nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold joining us live from the Washington Post. David, the big story out of Washington this morning, of course, is that Paul Manafort's been accused of lying and violating his plea agreement and could end up going to a prison for the rest of his life. So we still don't know what it is he lied about. Do you have any inside information on that?
We don't. I mean, I think a lot of our reporters have tried really hard to figure out what Mueller knows. I think Trump's team is trying hard to figure out what Mueller knows, and we still don't really. One consequence of this filing yesterday may be that there actually is some sort of open court hearing in which Mueller's team would lay out how they know Manafort has lied to them. And it's possible that in that open court hearing, we might hear more about what they know about what Trump did. You know, what Manafort has lied about could be something that some conversations he had with the president, something involving President Trump. You know, it's possible we could hear in open court through Manafort's case what Mueller thinks Trump did.
But that means he's basically out as a witness. They have to find somebody else if they're going to push this. I mean, is this a roadblock for Mueller's investigation?
It's really hard to know. I've heard both interpretations. One is that this is bad because Manafort was supposed to be a good witness for the Mueller investigation, and now obviously Manafort has gone sideways. It's possible that this is something that Mueller anticipated, and that he has, you know, the things he wanted Manafort to testify about, he already knows from other sources. Until we see it in open court, as with so much with Mueller, it's really hard to know what Mueller has until he lays his cards out.
Yeah, now this, of course, is not the only investigation Trump faces. There's the other one about in New York that you've been following up on, and remind us what that's about and what the stakes are there.
Well, the one in particular that I've been paying attention to is the Trump Foundation. So Trump had this charity for a long time. We wrote a lot about it in 2016. Basically, he had turned his charity into sort of another pocket of his wallet. He started using his charity's money to buy things like portraits to decorate the walls of his golf course, to pay off debts that his businesses owed. And so as a result, the New York Attorney General has filed suit against the Trump Foundation and against Trump and against his three eldest children, Eric, Ivanka, and Don, because they were theoretically directors of this Trump Foundation, although they actually didn't meet and did nothing. President Trump's lawyers, his private lawyers, have been trying to get this lawsuit from the New York Attorney General thrown out, kind of with a real smorgasbord of legal arguments. I've watched this hearing, and there were a few times when Trump's lawyers would go like, I mean, come on, everybody can see this, right? Uh-huh. Which is not ever a good sign for a lawyer. And so as expected, the judge overruled Trump's lawyers and said the case can continue. So now we could see possibly a testimony by President Trump in open court. Certainly the possibility of punishment and fines for Trump and his children.
But this is still small potatoes, right? We're talking about a few million dollars here. It hasn't got a big national profile. The other one is the emoluments case, though, which might lead to the release of his tax returns. Is there any progress in that one?
There's a couple of emoluments cases going, and the one that's more advanced, which is the D.C. and Maryland attorney general suing Trump, that has survived. Their suit has survived a couple of court challenges from Trump. It looks like the next step is going to be discovery, so they're going to be able to get documents, or at least they want to get documents from within the Trump hotel, the Trump hotel's customers, to learn about foreign governments and state governments using that hotel. Mm-hmm. There's no ask for Trump's tax returns as yet. There could be later on in that case. But getting some kind of internal records from that hotel seems likely, and it'll happen in the next few months.
Okay, the other story that broke this morning was, of course, the GM layoffs, which was out of the blue. I certainly wasn't expecting it. 14,700 people. It was pointed out in, I think it was on the Daily Beast, that the president's margin in Michigan was only 11,000 votes. And with layoffs of this size, could that have an effect in 2020? What's your take on that?
Well, we have a good story in the paper today from James Holman about that very thing. Trump had, in Michigan and in Ohio, where there were a lot of jobs were lost around Youngstown as a result of these GM layoffs, Trump said, you know, I know you're worried about American manufacturing jobs. I'll save those jobs. I'll bring them back. I'll protect them. And a lot of people saw him as kind of the vehicle through which they could recreate this sort of idyllic past where everybody, you know, could go to work at the GM plant and make enough to live a middle-class life. This is a sign that the policies Trump has pursued have not actually helped that dream come true. In fact, the opposite. One of the things he's done is impose steel tariffs, which help the steel industry but don't help any industry that relies on steel because it makes steel more expensive. So he's gained a few thousand steel jobs but now made it harder for companies like GM to manufacture cars. So it will be interesting in the next presidential election to see if those voters recognize or, you know, if they decide that Trump has duped them and not delivered what he promised.
And would that motivate him then to go for something bipartisan? I come back again because all of us have to drive on these federally funded highways to some kind of bill that would fix roads and bridges. Last time we talked, you said that that is not going to happen. And the reason is the Democrats, as much as this may benefit Democratic constituencies, are just not going to give Trump a victory under any circumstances. Is that still where you stand on that?
I still feel that way, both because of the way the Democrats are acting, but also the way Trump is acting. If you notice the way he has responded, you know, a lot of presidents lose big in their first midterm elections. Clinton did, Obama did, Bush did not because of 9/11. But often the reaction of presidents who lose big in the midterm elections is to tack more to the center, to look for bipartisan, you know, at least bipartisan rhetoric or try to get some bipartisan accomplishments. Clinton is probably the best example of that. Trump is not doing that. He's not reaching out to Democrats. He's not saying, okay, well, Democrats are in the House now. Let's talk about infrastructure. Next week, he's threatening to shut the government down over more money for a border wall. Trump has seemed to go further into his sort of base strategy of talking up tariffs, talking up immigration. I haven't seen a lot of effort from him to reach out to Democrats, which is what you need to get a big infrastructure bill done.
Speaking of border wall on immigration, as sad as the stories are from these people who are in the caravan trying to escape the disastrous countries that they're leaving, it strikes me that the images of people storming the border plays directly into the president's hands. I can't imagine that anybody at this point is going to say, sure, throw the gates open and let everybody in.
You're right. And there's been confrontations at the border the last few days as some of these migrant caravans have reached Tijuana in northern Mexico. I wonder what will happen there, both because I think the Mexican government and the Mexican people in those border towns are unhappy with it. They seem to be opposing more, you know, on the Mexican side, there's a lot more law enforcement and attempts to deport these folks back to Central America. But I think you're right. If those confrontations at the border continue and if people continue trying to storm the U.S. border, I think you'll see that does sort of make Trump's rhetoric seem a lot more reasonable.
Yeah, what's the Democrats' arguments for that? I mean, because he's going to accuse them of wanting open borders. It strikes me as these images make them pretty vulnerable.
they do not have a great argument for that. I think, you know, there's not another election until 2020, so we don't really know what the situation is going to be like then. But whoever comes out of the Democratic primary, I think, is going to need an immigration argument, you know, an immigration message that is goes beyond Donald Trump is bad, Donald Trump hates immigrants. You know, you're going to need to have some sort of rhetoric, especially if these sort of caravans or other challenges to the southern border continue. You're going to need some kind of plan about how, you know, if you don't think Trump's approach is right, well, what's your approach?
Right, exactly. David Farenthold, Washington Post. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. All of us want to toot our own horns, but some toots are legal and some toots are not. It's also illegal to read while driving, and so, since it is legal to listen to radio, we're going to create, through the magical use of sound effects, a film presentation based on the official State Department of Licensing Washington Driver Guide. Today, Section 4, page 15, we have wheeled in the radio projector and pulled down the radio screen. Let's roll it.
Use your horn. People cannot see you unless they are looking your way. Your horn can get their attention. Use it whenever it will help prevent a collision. If there is no immediate danger, a light tap on the horn should be all you need. Give your horn a light tap when a person on foot or on a bike appears to be moving into your lane of travel. When you're passing a driver who starts to turn into your lane. When a driver is not paying attention or may have trouble seeing you. When coming to a place where you cannot see what is ahead, like a steep hill, a sharp curve, or exiting a narrow alley. If there is danger, do not be afraid to sound a sharp blast on your horn. Do this when a child or older person is about to walk, run, or ride into the street. When another vehicle is in danger of hitting you. When you have lost control of your vehicle and are moving towards someone. When not to use your horn. There are several occasions when you should not use your horn. They include encouraging someone to drive faster or get out of the way. Letting other drivers know of an error. Greeting a friend. Around blind pedestrians. Passing bicyclists. Or when approaching horses.
So goes the film. So you cannot... You cannot issue punishment honks when another driver makes an error.
No, not legally. No. The biggest question where this comes up is, say you're at a traffic signal and the light turns green and you can see the person isn't paying attention. They've got their head buried in their phone or whatever. You know, do you blast them? Do you give them a light tap? How long do you give them? And in talking to doing this story a couple of times and in talking, the prevailing wisdom is you give the person about 2 seconds before you really let them know, you know, obviously it turns green, give them 1,002, a little doot doot. And if they don't pay attention after they don't do anything there, then you give them a little bit more of a love tap, to let them know. But the last thing you want to do is, I mean, the second it turns green, don't blast them because, you know, the last thing you want to do is incite road rage. But you also want to get people moving, and they shouldn't be buried in their phones anyway at the intersections. But, I mean, reality is reality.
So a flip-off honk as you speed past a left-lane camper, also not good?
No, that is not a good idea. You know, though, some things, and I've actually seen these advertised. I'm not sure if they're actually legal, but LED reader displays that people have in their back windows or whatever. So once they pass, you can program it to say whatever it is you want. I also would not recommend that. Though we have all felt that, the need to let someone know what they're doing.
That's actually being sold now. Huh?
Yes, at least I've seen them advertised. I haven't gone any further to see if it's actually legit. But either way, that could lead to some negativity and road rage as well. So, I mean, the best thing to do is just get on your way. And once that driver's in your rearview mirror, to not worry about them unless they decide to make it another issue.
Are any of these ever ticketed?
No, honking?
Yeah.
No. I mean, I can't say no because I don't know every agency or every...
I'd be curious to know if there's any cops listening who ever ticketed somebody for illegal honking.
Yeah, I mean, I would find it hard to imagine because, you'd have to be there to see it. You'd have to understand the context as well. So someone could argue, while waiting at a light, is the person's a danger because they're failing to move. I could argue that as a legit reason for getting for using the horn. So another person might read it a different way. But no, I can't think of anybody. I mean, think of it just in downtown. I mean, we'd be writing tickets nonstop.
Right.
And so there's real life, and then there's the manual that you need to memorize to pass your test.
What I do see is people who are honking at the car four cars ahead of me. Right, because they're stuck in traffic downtown, and the guy hasn't noticed the light has changed, or he's in the wrong lane for the turn he wants to make, and so you get a honk from somebody who's way back in the line.
Yeah, and that's distracting to you. You're like, what?
What did I do?
And it's like, you're at that point, you're honking at the person who's right behind the guy who hasn't honked yet. And so it's very hard to determine exactly what you're getting.
Well, they're trying to start a ripple honk.
Yeah, right? I guess so. We're starting a wave with a honk.
The other thing, suppose you see somebody, for example, with a flat tire, and you want to alert him to it.
They're driving and they've got a flat. I would say that's an unsafe situation that they're driving with. So if you want to pull up and give them a little honk and a point, I don't see where anyone would pick, because the last thing you want to do is have someone blow that tire significantly and cause an accident. But yeah, getting a driver's attention these days in a nice way to let them know your actions are pure. There's a lot of mistrust out there between drivers.
It's tough.
That's a hard one. But yeah, I've done that before where I've gone up and I pointed back, or I've had people do that to me, and I appreciate it because I don't want to be driving on a flat. I don't want to have a major blowout like that.
And you're not allowed to install a little bullhorn in your car like the cops have to say, your tire's flat.
No, or
get out of the way. Or that,
yeah. Left lane is for passing.
Right.
No, that is also not.
By the way, you need a new battery for your bullhorn. It sounds pretty bad.
Yeah, it is. It's